I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, I'm Claire Mutimer.
And I'm Susie Coulson. Welcome to The Backstory. In each episode, we'll be hearing about an experience that has happened to someone that shaped who they are.
30 minutes that remind us that everyone's dealing with something. So we're a documentary podcast. A docupod.
Except you made that word up. Welcome back to a brand new season of The Backstory. Now, I'd love to chat, but we have a fascinating story this week, which is part of a bigger theme for this whole season. So, Claire, do you want to tell us a bit more about what's coming up?
Yes, we have four stories which go right to the heart of why we make these podcasts. Stories that really show what people are contending with behind the scenes. For these next four episodes, we're going to be talking to people who have had to fight for justice. Their stories of determination and bloody-minded grit, of considering giving up but deciding to carry on. All very different stories, but all with the common experience of a horrific event followed by a battle for justice.
Okay, and our first story is a two-parter. Claire went to meet Penny to hear about her search for justice in a story that spans decades. Claire, can you give us a bit of an intro?
Yeah, so this story is about a woman called Penny Farmer who lost her brother Christopher in 1978. Christopher was travelling with his girlfriend Peter. They were both in their early 20s and were travelling around America together. Penny, Christopher's sister, was 19 and at home in the UK, getting ready to go off to university. In the 70s, of course, we were pre-internet and mobiles, but Christopher and girlfriend Peter kept in touch with their families through regular letters home. But then the letters stopped. In this part one, Penny tells us what happened in 1978, or what she knew at that time. And next week, this story is brought bang up to date with the help of a huge discovery using Facebook, which helped Penny uncover a whole host of truths about her brother's case.
Heads up, this is a story with some horrific events. If you think it may not be for you, then perhaps proceed with caution. As always, we've put helping agencies in the show notes. Here's Penny talking to Claire.
So on The Backstory, we like to have like a significant thing that's happened in your life. And certainly with you, Penny, there's been a hugely significant thing that's happened in your life. And so I wonder if you can just sort of start by telling us what happened in 1978.
Okay, so my brother, who was age 25, he and his girlfriend, Peter, had finished their studies at Birmingham University. Peter had studied law, Chris had studied medicine. So they had always wanted to go travelling. They were real, you know, travellers. They started off by going to Australia, and then having worked for 6 months there, my brother and Peter then moved over to Los Angeles and travelled down through Mexico until they reached Belize. They met a couple just by chance who said that there was great Barrier Reef along the Belizean coastline, and they being real surfers and divers and swimmers wanted to go and explore it.
Wow.
So that was how their adventure, you know, began, really, from Australia moving over to Central America.
And so this was like 1978. How often were you hearing from them? Because obviously there wasn't, you know, the emails and texts and stuff that we're getting nowadays.
Like, no.
What would you...
Well, for those days, we were in unbelievable, you know, close t- touch, really. Right. I mean, albeit by my brother used to record tapes on his what he called his boombox, and record those and send us quite detailed travel logs. But Peter was a absolute consummate letter writer to her mother, and wrote these almost journal style letters back home. And I don't think there was ever really a week that we didn't hear from either one of them.
Wow, right. And so the letters kept coming, or?
Yep, they kept coming up until the end of June. And then we heard nothing from them at all throughout July.
Right.
And obviously our anxieties grew as to what could have happened to them. And for a while, you know, we thought maybe they had fallen ill, or, you know, there was a postal strike or something. But by early August, we were really concerned. And then I think it was August the 4th, we received a letter which was dated, the last date was June the 28th with a postscript of June the 29th saying that she hadn't been able to post it. So it was an update. But it was a letter that arrived in August. So, and it had a post date of July the 18th from Livingston in Guatemala. So we were really puzzled by this letter, because there was a 2-week gap between the posting of it and her last postscript. Never would she post a letter without, you know, adding a postscript and then posting it immediately.
Right.
So our concerns were really raised by then.
And so was your mum and dad talking to Peter's mum and dad all the time? How did that
By then, I mean, yes, because both sets of parents were very concerned. Well, we had grown up living opposite each other in a suburb of Manchester called Chorlton. So you know, we literally lived in opposite houses, and, you know, there were three of us and five of them. Chris and Peter had started going out together when they were 14, so childhood sweethearts.
So what happened after that? Like, how did you got this one letter, and did that sort of, that raised hope that, you know, they probably were okay? It was just that they're out of communication.
Well, it was good to receive, but it just left a huge question mark. It raised more questions than answers, really, because, you know, what had happened to them throughout July? There was no mention of anything after June the 29th, which was bizarre and totally out of character.
So what did your parents do after that?
So they decided to go to the Foreign Office. My father was a BBC journalist, BBC television director. So he was very adept at alerting the media. And they went on television doing appeals to, you know, anyone who travelled in Central America and that area, you know, particularly Guatemala, Belize, that we knew they had last been in. By the end of October, the Foreign Office told us that the skipper of the boat, Silas Duane Boston, a Californian, had sold the boat in northern Belize, and had reappeared back on the radar, back in his hometown of Sacramento,
right,
in California, Northern California. And they then interviewed him by telephone to ask what had happened to their whereabouts. We knew where they were from this letter of Peter's that we had received in August. So it was unbelievably detailed, that letter. You know, we knew from that letter that they were on a boat, a private boat, owned by Boston, the skipper, that there were his two sons were on board, ages 13 and 12, Vince and Russell. And we knew where they were going. My father had quite fortuitously contacted the harbour master in Belize to discover that that they had been on the boats, the inventory, to say that they were on it when it left harbour.
Right.
But they weren't on the boat when it put in Livingston in Guatemala in July. So
that news must have been pretty big for your parents.
Absolutely. So we knew that, well, but the question was, what had happened out at sea?
And so you found out that they hadn't arrived in the next port with these guys.
Yeah.
And what happened after that?
So after that, the Foreign Office, having spoken to Boston on the phone, then called him in for questioning into the consul in San Francisco.
Right.
And the consulate general was very much under the impression and wrote down in a report that he felt like 99% sure that Boston knew a lot more than he was saying. Mm. By this time, his story as to where he had put them down, he said, was changing rapidly. And it was, you know, it was just not a stable story that he was telling. And apparently his body language was such that he looked very guilty. So they had a very strong suspicion that he was the perpetrator of the crime. But of course, they weren't a law enforcement agency. But it was then put into the hands of the Sacramento police.
Right.
They interviewed him as well subsequently, wanted to take him down because he kept saying that he had put them ashore on the peninsula, which juts out from Guatemala.
Right.
And they wanted to take him down to there to show them where he'd put them, but he refused. And then what happened after that was that this was in early 1979. He completely went off the radar and went on the run with both his sons. The police, I think, did make quite strenuous efforts to try and interview both of the boys, but he'd taken them, and if they weren't on the run with him, then his two parents, who were both divorced, harboured them and sheltered them from being interviewed. It was only in February that the Foreign Office reported to us that two bodies had been found 200 metres offshore, tortured and weighted down with engine parts. And then subsequently buried unidentified on July the 8th.
Oh, so they had discovered the bodies, but they just had not known who they were, and
buried unidentified. They were the divers got them out of the sea, and they had obvious signs of torture. They had plastic bags over their heads, and they were roped together, hogtied.
Do you still find that shocking? Like the thought of that happening to you then?
Just unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, the sheer sort of heinous nature of the crime is just hideous, really.
You heard about this in February. That's when you found out that the bodies had been found.
They reported that, and then we had to go through another further 2 months of waiting because we had their dental records flown out. And it wasn't until April the 10th that we got the news that they had a positive identification, that, you know, and so then we knew conclusively that it was them.
And so how do your parents and yourselves and Peter's family deal with that?
I think in a sort of way, it was a relief to know, because we'd had 10 months of not knowing, and the last 2 months were torturous. You know, we were waiting and waiting on news, which, you know, it's hard to appreciate in this day of instant communication just how awful that is, waiting for those letters to arrive or the phone call to come. So, it was agony, really. I think in our heart of hearts, we all knew that it was going to be them, because the likelihood of it not being, you know, two Westerners of that similar description, it would have been, freaky for it not to have been them. But it was still tremendously upsetting to have got that conclusive proof, because then all hope was gone.
Yeah. Did you feel that there was like a kind of conscious decision as to how your parents sort of reacted to the news? That was it about finding justice? Like, what was their sort of driving force once they knew this awful news?
To you know, get justice for Chris and Peter, because, you know, it was just so inexplicable how two decent human beings could end up in that state, you know. And it was obvious whoever had done it was sick, and needed to be put away.
And I mean, I let on to you that I've been through a slightly similar situation, that my brother was also murdered abroad. And like, it's from my point of view, it's so distant, and that made it very difficult kind of to relate to a lot of it. And also, it felt sometimes that he was, you know, killed away. Maybe people didn't realise how loved he was at home, sort of thing. Is that sort of, does that kind of chime with you? And I guess you had that added thing of trying to, you know, bring somebody to justice on your own, as it were. And it was very much like, it must have felt a lot like your family's responsibility to try and sort of fight for this.
It was put into the hands of the Greater Manchester Police, but my parents were still very much, I felt, and they felt very much in charge and directing the case, because I think the Greater Manchester Police were as much of a loss as to know what to do as we were, really, because it was unusual to be handling an international case like this, which involved, you know, two British citizens who were the victims, and the perpetrator being American, Californian, and it happening in Guatemalan waters. It was just, the jurisdiction was
so
just
complicated.
So, yeah.
So tell me about your dad, because he, like, I think got very involved, didn't he?
He did, yes. Yeah, I mean, he became obsessed with it, really. He was so driven, along with my mother as well, you know, that they, any opportunity to write to anyone who might have a grain of any interest in the story. So, yeah. So you know, by 1979, we were, you know, pretty darn sure who had killed them. Yeah. Why, we didn't know, or why they should be tortured and end up in that state, we didn't know. But we knew who had done it.
And you had no access to Vince and Russell, who obviously you assumed might have known something.
No, yeah. I mean, we kept saying to the police, please interview the two boys. You know, it was a small boat, a 30-foot boat, you know, unless it had happened at night. But then they must surely have asked the question, where have they gone in the morning?
Yeah.
You know, we felt sure that they held the key to knowing what had happened. He just went on the run all over California, and going up and down the Californian coast and disappearing over the Mexican border.
Right.
You know, and slipping into obscurity down in Baja in Mexico.
You used that geography very carefully, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. And the other critical piece of information that we were told was that the mother of the two boys, Vince and Russell, a woman called Mary Lou Boston, whom he was divorced from in 1968, had disappeared in September 1968, never to be seen again. And she was down as a missing person, but that also raised huge question marks over Boston. Subsequently, we were to find out that the reason he was down in Belize was because he jumped bail on a serious rape charge of a minor.
And so tell me a bit more about the letters that you had from Peter. Like, what was she saying about what was happening, and had they been enjoying their time on the boat?
I think initially they did. They enjoyed the sort of carefree, sort of bohemian lifestyle which Boston offered. He had set up this business when he had first gone down to Belize in early 1978, whereby he took tourists, you know, the foreigners, right, off to the little keys that scattered that coastline. They were, and I believe still are, very pretty.
Yeah.
And he took them on sort of day trips and made it into a sort of like Robinson Crusoe sort of offering, if you see what I mean, you know, making barbecues and bonfires on the keys.
Very delicious.
And
and
catching the fish. And so he did that sort of day experience. And and I think that was how Chris and Peter came to be introduced. They met in a bar in one of these remote little islands off Belize.
Right.
And it was just a chance meeting. And from what I understand, he was incredibly charismatic, very popular, a great raconteur.
Right.
Not particularly attractive, but what he lacked in looks, he made up for in his very deep, gravelly voice he had, apparently. It was called the Boston Charm.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, he was a chameleon, from what I gather.
And so they joined him on the boat, and in her letter, like, what had she said about being on the boat with him?
So it started off fine, but in her last letter home, which we, as I say, got in August, there was evidence that things were starting to go awry on the boat, that Boston regularly beat up his children and was abusive to them, and was losing his temper regularly with them, and he was drinking too much. So we knew that as well from her letter.
Right, yeah.
But as I say, it was the question mark was, and especially after their bodies had been discovered, we then knew that the letter had been posted some 10 days after we were that they were known to have died.
Ah, so you knew
We knew then whoever posted that letter needed it as an alibi. You know, it was to cover up that they were dead.
Right, right, right. Interesting. So you knew it wasn't them that had posted the letter.
Yeah.
So you went off to university.
I mean, I was relieved in some ways to get away from home because it was quite a depressing place to be.
Imagine. Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, it sounds awful, but I was glad to get away and change the scenery.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that I don't think I really coped with it at the time or dealt with it, I think has led to me never really getting over it in some ways to the point now where I'm still dealing with it, if you know what I mean. It was like an epiphany, really. It was a defining moment. It was a beautiful October day, and it was, you know, crystal clear, gin blue sky. And I was in a field walking the dogs with my mother, who was by then 91. Oh. And, you know, I said to Mum, you know, gosh, you know, what a beautiful day. And such shame that Chris isn't alive. And she said, yes, I wonder what he'd look like now. You know, he'd be 62. And it just literally came to me from out of the blue, really. Why on earth had I not looked on the internet for Boston and his two sons? It's literally that thought.
Right.
And I thought to myself, you know, I bet I can find them if I just drill down far enough and really try. And so I literally raced home and got my laptop out, got the file out that, you know, my parents had collated back in 1978 and 79, and started looking for them. And not very long after that, I found them.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Claire, I don't really know where to start. It's such a shocking event.
Yes. I need to be careful not to talk about anything that comes up in part two, but there's a lot more to this story, which we'll hear next week. As suggested by the end there, we are in 2015 for part two, and Penny suddenly realises that Boston's sons, who were about 11 or 12 at the time, and according to Peter's letters home, would have been on the boat when Peter and Chris were murdered, were now probably traceable on Facebook.
And all these years later, she was going to find out what actually happened to her brother.
So part two is out next week on Tuesday, the 19th of February. Do make sure that you're subscribed. But first, let's return to discuss some of the pressing issues from part one.
Yeah, I wanted to kick off by talking about how this story really highlights how communication has changed from 1978 until now. In fact, these guys were in close contact due to Peter's prolific and detailed letters to her family. But that was pretty unusual and obviously is nothing like the contact travellers can now have with their families and friends back home, with constant messages, calls and Insta updates.
Yeah, it was so different, wasn't it? I can remember when I went travelling, so this would have been kind of 10 years, well, you know, about 10 years later in 89, 90. And yeah. I think I called home once in 4 months because it was just so expensive. We did write letters, but they were very few and far between and they probably took weeks to get home. And really, when I look back, I feel so bad for my parents. You know, they never tried to stop me or dissuade me, but they must have been absolutely worried sick.
Maybe they weren't.
Or just happy to get very relieved for a few months. Yeah. I remember when I was coming back, I didn't tell them that I was coming home and I thought I'd just surprise them. So I turned up at my dad's office and I can remember the look on his face, you know, just absolute sheer relief and definitely just shock and disbelief and a slight sense of disappointment.
Oh, she's back in the house again.
No, you know, my oldest is 16, so I can see it now from, you know, from the other side and just how difficult it must be, or it must have been, to see your children go off traveling and
definitely
and not be able to contact them.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing now is that a lot of mobile phone data would have probably been used to like locate Chris and Peter,
of course,
and like, even Boston.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And I think it was a lot easier to commit a crime and get away with it back then.
Yeah, I wonder whether it was. Yeah. Do you think it was maybe quite a special thing though for young people, you know, to have that freedom that comes from basically really poor communication, you know, just to be able to kind of go
I wonder
under
if
the
it
radar.
Was more of a rite of passage for young people when you know, they could go away with that freedom of no need to call for weeks on end and you know, not having to tell anyone where they were. I vaguely remember like phone cards and credits and getting cut off like mid-sentence, like on these sort of, you know, one-off calls when I was traveling. But I think fundamentally many young people will travel for different reasons maybe now. It's sort of now that the travel is like so documented and shared, and if we aren't careful, like probably a bragging experience.
Oh, God.
Like, rather than before when it was mostly a personal kind of experience that was quite isolated.
Yes.
And a few photos developed when you got home. Like these days there probably isn't much to say when you get back because everyone's been following you all the way around, which, you know, which is fine too. It's just really different.
Yeah, it is very different. So Penny was off to university in the midst of all of this, and it must have been really hard for her, you know, the impact of losing someone so traumatically when you're young. And Claire, you touched on losing your brother in the recording. I wonder, did you feel a special connection to Penny's experience?
Yeah, we definitely did. And we shared some tears. My brother was killed in the terrorist bombings in Bali in 2002. So I had, yeah, very direct connection with Penny. I was 24 when it happened to me, and my brother was 28. So we were slightly older. But yes, I really knew how that kind of, I suppose, out of the blue tragic event of losing a brother felt, and also that disconnect of it happening so far away. I think these enormous events early in our lives carve right into the person you become. I think I was lucky in that my family were quite open about talking. Penny describes quite a sort of stiff upper lip feeling in her family, which perhaps I think she said that might have affected her coming to terms with it all.
I wonder as well whether, because the murders were unsolved for so long and her parents were, you know, very understandably completely absorbed in trying to seek justice for Chris and Peter, whether that perhaps meant that they didn't grieve the loss in the same way that you would with another more straightforward death.
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing that really has helped Penny was writing, and she wrote a book about all these events called Dead in the Water, which I have obviously read, and it details this whole story and is a fascinating read. So I would highly recommend getting that if you're interested in this story, and we'll put a link to it.
I wonder what the long-term effect is of losing someone in this way. I was listening to Bob Mortimer on Desert Island Discs just recently, which is an episode that I would very highly recommend.
Yeah.
And he talked about losing his father when he was 7. I think he'd clearly done a lot of reflecting on this. And he talks about being a people helper because he doesn't want people to leave him. So, you know, it makes me wonder what was the effect on Penny and, you know, I guess also what the effect on you has been, if you don't mind me asking.
No, I'm not really sure. I've always been very aware, I suppose, that I no longer have any siblings alive. So I suppose I have maybe sort of subconsciously invested in my close friends. And I think, you know, they are exceptionally important to me. Mm. But I don't know what it's done to my character. Maybe I'm more anxious of losing someone. I definitely do think about my family members a lot in that context. So I think that's probably quite likely. Yeah, so as you've just mentioned Desert Island Discs, perhaps now's a good time to pause our discussion about Penny's backstory. There's definitely lots more to say, but we'll pick it up again once we've heard part two next week. Shall we move on to our podcast recommendations?
Sure. Okay. Have you got one for us?
Yes. Well, some of you might have seen from our social media feeds that I saw Dolly Alderton in Norwich last week, which made me feel a bit old as it was definitely aimed at the millennials. But she was seriously eloquent. And so in prep for seeing that, I listened to her Love Stories podcast. And I particularly enjoyed the recent one with Adam Kay as her guest. I loved his book, This Is Going to Hurt, about being a doctor, and the amazing, funny and sort of poignant stories about that.
Oh, God. So hang on. There's an anecdote, isn't there, you told me about today. People
yeah.
need to listen out for...
Listen out for the proposal story, which involves the proposer's vagina and something getting stuck. It's very, very interesting. So, yeah, so I would recommend that because it's really great. And they talk about all his loves and especially the bit about the NHS is really, like, beautiful.
Okay, sounds good.
So what about you, Susie? Any listening gems?
Well, I don't know whether I've mentioned this one before, actually. The Guardian's In Focus. It's kind of like the Daily for the UK.
Well, you not mentioned the Guardian one, but the Daily. My God, we've heard about it a thousand times, I think.
Absolute favourite. Well, one of my absolute favourites.
So it's a current affairs type of programme, is it?
Yeah, it is. And it has a really nice tone, especially if you're a bit of a woolly liberal like me. So I like it anyway. And I thought there was a definite gap for that kind of daily format in the UK.
Yeah,
so it's worth a listen.
Definitely have a listen to that. So also make sure you listen to part two of this fascinating story next week. We really can't recommend pressing subscribe highly enough. It's free despite the word, which feels like there's some kind of like hidden payment behind it.
I know, but that's a real bugbear for us, isn't it? It makes it sound as though you're going to pay for something, but you're not completely free. Do also please recommend us to your family and friends. We've got a really strong season coming up that we think deserves lots of listens. So if you've enjoyed this, please share the episode on Facebook and Twitter. Help us out and share as much as you can. That would be great.
Have a good week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We are the Backstory Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. At the Backstory Pod on Twitter. Search for The Backstory with Claire and Susie in your podcast directory.
For sponsorship opportunities, or if you'd like to take part in a show, please contact hello@thebackstorypodcast.co.uk. The Backstory Podcast is produced by Tin Shed Productions.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.